call this hearing of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is now 3:32 on Tuesday, February 4th, 2025. Members present so far are just myself, Vice Chair Senator Giesel, and myself, Chair Dunbar. We believe two of our other colleagues will be coming along shortly. We don't have a quorum, but that's okay because we're not moving anything today. We are hearing a presentation, and I'm sure that my colleagues will also be able to Senator Klayman. We will also be able to watch this recording. Before we begin, I would like to thank Mary Gwen Kawakami, the Senate Health and Social Services Recording Secretary, and Shelby Carroll from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. We have one item on our agenda. It's a presentation from the Department of Family and Community Services. Here in the room, we have Commissioner Kim Koval, Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lasley, and Assistant Commissioner Marianne Sweet. On the phone, we also have Heidi Hamilton, who's the Director of the Alaska Pioneers Home, Kim Gway, the Director of the Office of Children's Services, Scott York, the Director of the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and Matt Davidson, the Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. I believe we also have Senior Policy Advisor Chrissy Vogely and Liaison Ramey Matuszewski, who is in the room with us. So if we would, Commissioner, if you want to bring your team forward and put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. How's the sound?
Great.
Good? Great. Excellent. Thank you. For the record, Kim Koval, Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. Thank you for having us here today. We're really pleased to present on our department and a lot of the great things that we've been able to accomplish since the reorganization. We're going to go through our slide deck and then happy to answer any questions as we're going along. So we have all the folks identified. We also want to say a special welcome to our MSW practicum student who's in the gallery, Shayna Cooper. This is her first trip in Juno, and she has been having a really great time learning and meeting with legislators as well. So we just want to give her a welcome. As a refresher for all of you who have been here, this is the reorganization of the department. We like to put this slide in because it always seems to help when folks ask some questions that seem to cross over with our twin sister agency. And we have them broken down into the divisions here. We're really pleased to share that this reorganization has been very successful in helping us be more agile, nimble, and responsive to our division needs as well as our sister agency as well. We have had a very focused approach on delivering direct care to Alaskans, including our youth, our patients, and our elders. As you know, our facilities are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and we are very proud of our staff in our community settings as well. We find that with this organization, we've had really great collaboration with stakeholders, our partners, federal, local, tribal, and we've been developing some really fantastic strategies as we're moving forward within our divisions. This is our mission, is to provide and support safety, personal well-being for vulnerable Alaskans. And as you know, we have our four divisions, the Pioneer Homes, the Psychiatric Institute, Division of Juvenile Justice, and Office of Children's Services. This is our organization chart. We have our key divisions and leadership on here, as well as our special assistants and our advisory boards. So first we have the Pioneer Homes. The Pioneer Homes provide services including assistance with activities of daily living, nursing services, recreational social programs, assistance with medication, dietary needs, housekeeping, and meal preparation. The homes provide a wide range of services and activities for our most independent to those living with dementia-related diseases or advanced complex care needs. 64% of our residents in our Pioneer Homes have a diagnosed dementia-related disease. And we have over 400 positions and a budget of just over $112 million.
Can I pause you there for a second, Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
So I apologize if you go into this more later on, but can you describe a little bit how things have changed in the last couple of years at the Pioneer Homes, or perhaps the director could? I know that there were some concerns about some of the facilities being sort of under some unusual stress in recent years, and also having concerns about, I believe, Fairbanks in particular. I could be misremembering, but could you highlight maybe, or could the director highlight some of those changes?
Thank you, Chair Dunbar. Do you want to have Heidi jump on this one?
Sure.
Okay. So, yes, we do have Director Hamilton on the line.
Thank you. Director Hamilton?
Yes, I'm here. This is Director Hamilton from the Pioneers Home. Basically, our changes are we're seeing both the residents that are living in the homes and the residents that are on our wait list to move in are having more complex needs. We got higher and higher percentages of residents who have need higher levels of care. Those are the highest 3, 4, and 5. We've opened our complex care neighborhood that has 9 beds for residents that haven't been able to be served other places, either in the community or within our homes. And those beds have been full for 2 years. And we have people on our wait list that need those services. In addition, we're seeing more residents that are needing either payment assistance or meeting qualifications for Medicaid waiver. So our payment sources are changing a little bit. And staffing has been more difficult, basically, since COVID. But those numbers are starting to turn around a little bit. Those are the biggest changes we're seeing. Heavier care, a little harder to find staff.
Thank you, Director. Is there any particular facility around Alaska that you feel, the facilities you have around Alaska, which of them do you feel is under sort of the most pressure, or perhaps which physical facility has the most problems?
Each home has its own particular needs. Fairbanks is home. The infrastructure there is really not meeting our residents' needs. And staffing is more complex and difficult up in Fairbanks. Anchorage is seeing more and more residents who have less payment sources, who come from more troubled backgrounds. So those are probably our two big areas that we're struggling with.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for the director? All right. I'm sorry. Senator Giesel.
Well, I only have a comment, and that is to thank the Pioneer Homes, particularly the one in Anchorage, who cared for my mother, who was in the dementia unit. She had excellent care. So kudos.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Commissioner, can you please continue with the presentation?
Thank you. For the record, Kim Koval. Okay, next we're going to quickly go over Alaska Psychiatric Institute, or API. We are Alaska's only state-run hospital that provides acute psychiatric care to individuals, adults and youth, experiencing mental health crisis. There are 5 inpatient units with a total of 80 beds to provide compassionate health care to support Alaskans. Again, API is the only entity in the state that also provides competency restoration services and treatment for individuals who have been found by the court to incompetent to stand trial. Our budget this year is at $62.5 million.
Similar question, Commissioner, and perhaps you can throw it to your, as we go through these, perhaps you can throw it to your directors about, I'm sort of curious, the change since the last time we talked to you, last year, if they have anything they want to update us on.
Well, we could probably do that one ourselves, but. I'll start and then I can have Scott join on if that's all right. Chair Dunbar, thank you for the question. We have seen really incredible changes with API steadily since the stress points from 2019. We are full at API, and full can range from anywhere from 72 to 80. And the reason why there's a range is because one section does have dual beds, and sometimes it's not appropriate to put 2 patients in a 2-bed room. So sometimes we do have to restrict the room to 1 patient. We do have a plethora of services that are going on in different treatment programs. We do have 10 youth beds. The balance are adult beds, and then we also have 10 forensic beds, which are full. We've also expanded the forensic program to extend outside of API, and we are providing forensic services at the Anchorage Correctional Complex, the Highland Women's Correctional Complex, and then also in our community area where these are already patients that are in the community. We have had a massive reduction in regards to patient-on-patient and patient-on-staff negative interactions would be, you know, if there's assault or things like that. So we have seen a tremendous change. We have pretty steady staff. We have a lot of also resident students who are taking residency with our program there from multiple colleges from across the United States. And Dr. Becker proudly recruits from that cohort quite often. So we are seeing, again, some really great improvements. But Scott York is also on the line as well.
Mr. York, if you could identify yourself.
Hi, Scott York. I'm the director at Alaska Psychiatric Institute.
Did you hear the question?
You wanted to know an update since the last time presented to the Senate?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, Commissioner Cobalt really pretty much spoke to a lot of it. Our census has increased. We are running at high capacity. Commissioner said, that we don't always hit the 80 mark because there's sometimes we have patients that can't have roommates. We have seen an improvement in our therapeutic programming. Commissioner also said, our therapeutic programming has improved. We opened our Denali unit, which was for patients that are cognitively impaired. And we actually received from the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association an award, the Beacon Award, for the development of that program. So we're very proud of that. Our staff are doing a great job. We have another program that we've done with our adult civil patients to improve more of the therapy and more movement of our units. We have opened the outpatient restoration and the jail-based restoration programs. Since that opened in November of 23, the jail-based program was expanded from ACC to include the female inmates at Highland Correctional. And I think those are the big high points. If there's any more I can answer, please ask.
Yes, I have a question from Senator Klayman.
First, with regard to the competency beds, what is your average length of time that folks are in hold on the competency process?
So I looked last week, and our length of stay that folks are on the wait list, I think that's what you're asking. Is that correct?
Not on the wait list. I'm asking once they get into API and they're in the competency program or the treatment process, how long are they there before they're either found to be competent because they've been restored to competency or to conclude that you can't get them to competency so they would essentially get moved off of that ward?
I'm going to apologize. I don't have that exact number with me, but I'm happy to get that for you, and we can get that for you tomorrow.
Follow up. And be interested in the wait list as well, but I was also interested in how long folks are staying. And then separately, there's the 80 licensed beds, and I just need a memory refresher. Is that the total number of beds in the building, or are there actually more beds that are not set up for treatment?
Thank you, Senator Klayman, and through the chair. We have 80-bed facility. 10 of those beds are forensic. 60 beds are for civil adults, and we have 10-bed children, which is the CHILCAT unit. You asked about the wait list. Our wait list as of last week was about 45. And the amount of time that they're on the wait list is about 160 days.
Wow. Thank you. Is that good, Senator Klayman?
Yes.
Thank you.
Had to think about that.
No worries. Well, thank you, Mr. Scott. I don't see any other questions. So, Commissioner, if you'd like to go on to the next slide.
Good afternoon. For the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Family and Community Services. The next division that we're going to highlight is the Division of Juvenile Justice. Division of Juvenile Justice follows the restorative justice model, and it's reflected in its mission to hold juveniles accountable for their behavior, promote safety and restoration of victims and communities, and assist offenders and their families in developing the skills to prevent crime. DJJ has six facilities across the state with a total of about 155 youth in services. We also have 13 probation offices across the state. Oftentimes individuals do not realize that only about a third of our youth are actually in facilities. We have a little over 530 youth that are on probation. So we manage most of our youth through the probation services across the state, but we do operate the six facilities. DJJ has 400 full-time positions and a budget of $67 million. And Director Davidson, he's our newest director within the division. He was at Juvenile Justice previously. He came to work for us over in the commissioner's office for a couple of years, and we're excited that he was appointed as the new director of the Division of Juvenile Justice. And he's on the line, Senator Klayman, or Senator Dunbar, if you would like to have him provide those updates.
Yeah, that would be great. Director Davidson, if you wouldn't mind providing sort of the highlights of any changes since the last time we heard from DJJ here. I'll say also for my own curiosity, I believe you managed the MYC facility, and I know that there was an issue with the intake facility that the court system was using, and there was discussion about changing its sort of layout and maybe even doing some facilities changes, and I wonder if you had any information on that. So one broad question and one very specific.
Sure. Good afternoon. This is Matt Davidson. I am the director of the Division of Juvenile Justice, located here in Juneau. Happy to be with you. The deputy commissioner stole my tagline about the biggest change for me personally is rejoining the division as the director. It's been my pleasure to be in this position since November. We have a great team here. I'd say most significantly since the previous director presented to this group and the department, we have made some gains in terms of our hiring. We still have some problem areas, but we have really improved the vacancy, especially on the vacancy rate, especially on the facility side. Whereas we're about at 11% vacancy rate, which is about half of what it was a year and a half prior. Your question about the McLaughlin Youth Center, a unit called the Detention Court Unit, I think we toured there a couple years ago. There is a proposal in the capital budget to move some money to help renovate that portion of McLaughlin Youth Center. And so we are hopefully going to be able to do some improvements there. That's called the Detention Court Unit. There's no issue with the court itself. It's just that particular unit is in bad need of some deferred maintenance and renovation.
Thank you. And yes, I remember that from the tour I took there in my district. Any questions from the committee? Senator Giesel.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Do you have a sense, or could you share any numbers, how many of the youth that are confined in your facilities have identifiable behavioral health issues that are at the root of their challenges?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Giesel, I'm very confident to say a very high percentage of the youth we serve in our facilities have one or more diagnoses. In fact, the youth that go through our treatment programming all have diagnosis. I think it's 70% have a dual diagnosis of a behavioral health and a substance abuse concern. So, yeah, that's very common for our youth that we serve. So, in fact, we have, on staff mental health clinicians in every facility, and we do have contract providers who provide behavioral health and substance use services.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Kiesel. I'm not seeing any more questions. Thank you very much, Director Davidson, and we'll move on to the next slide.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner. The next division that we're going to highlight is the Office of Children's Services. This is our primary child welfare agency in the state of Alaska, responsible for ensuring the safety of Alaska's children, investigating reports of harm and child abuse and neglect, and administering the state's foster care system. We have 21 offices spread all across the state of Alaska, with 600 full-time positions and a budget of just a little over $200 million. This division also has made some really significant improvements, and I think they're doing a great job. On the line with us today is the director of the Office of Children's Services, Kim Gui. And just before we pass it over to her to answer the questions that you've posed, Chairman, I want to throw out kudos to Director Gui. This week she will celebrate her 25th anniversary with Office of Children's Services. So, Director Gui.
Well, good afternoon. For the record, this is Kim Gui, Director of Office of Children's Services. Thank you for that, DC Lastly. It's been a great 25 years. Appreciate every day the work that Office of Children does, Services does for the state of Alaska. Some great changes that we've had over this last year since we were able to meet last. We have seen a very slow and safe reduction of children in care. It's a number that's steadily decreasing, and we're keeping an eye to make sure that we are in the right frame when we're reducing children in care. What we are seeing is we're also seeing a reduction of vacancy and turnover within OCS. It's still much higher than where we would like. We're at 37%. Our highest was during COVID at 59%. So we are trending in the right way. We are still have a lot of focus on our staff and our recruitment and things of that nature. So we are continuously working on that. Some of the great things that we are seeing is that we are trending up on reunification back with their parents, which is a great statistic. We're above the national average on making sure children are reunifying with their families. And so lots going on over here. We've got a lot of initiatives that we're working on. We are getting ready to enter round four of our Child and Family Services Review with the federal government this year. So we're prepping for that and doing a lot of outreach with our partners around the state that comprise the child welfare system.
Thank you.
I'll pause and see if anyone has any questions.
I do. Thank you, Director Gui. And first, I'll say that, if we saw a 37% vacancy rate in almost any other department or division, it would be a crisis. But I think we're all well aware of how difficult it is to recruit and retain people to the Office of Children's Services. It's just one of the most difficult jobs you can do in any profession, and I'm always really impressed by people that are able to stick it out, and the fact that you've been there 25 years is remarkable. So thank you for your service. The question I had was about the fact that we are above the national average with family reunification, and I actually find that a little bit surprising. Unfortunately, on most statistics, Alaska tends to lag. We have the highest rates of a variety of problematic indicators, much of which is centered in rural Alaska where I grew up. And so my question is, to what do you attribute that success? I mean, what is it that allows Alaska to be above the national average in family reunification?
That's a great question, Chair Dunbar. I don't think it's a one simple answer, but what I can say, some other national data, is we do tend to keep children in care a little bit longer here in Alaska. And I think part of that is due to service providers and how hard it could be to get into services in rural Alaska and things of that nature. But I also think
because kids tend to stay in care, it's only like 3 more months than the national average, I think it also gives parents that opportunity to really engage and help change behaviors. And so those are some of the things that we are seeing. I don't think that's the only indicator, but that is definitely one of the indicators that I think contributes to a higher reunification rate.
Thank you. That's very interesting. I think you could see how an advocate would perhaps think that a child staying in the services of the state for longer on average would be negative for the family. But what you're indicating is that might not actually be the case, and sort of counterintuitively, it gives the family in some cases a chance to get back on their feet and be ready to be reunified with the child. So I appreciate that answer. Any questions from the panel? Vice Chair Giesel.
Thank you. Director Guay, I missed the percent of reunifications. Could you repeat that percentage?
Yes, of the number of children, thank you for the question. For the number of children that are removed, 55% are being reunified with their family. The national average, which their data, the most current data is from 2022 for the federal government, so it's lagging behind our data for sure, but their national data was a little 48%. Sorry, I was just grabbing that number. 48% is the national average for reunification, and we're at 55%.
Senator Giesel?
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Giesel.
So I don't know if you heard me ask Mr. Davidson this. I'm wondering if you could quantify the number of children in the that are removed from families due to substance abuse disorder or other behavioral health issues on the part of the parents?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Giesel, over 80 to 90% of our cases, I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but it's very high on substance use disorders, closely followed by mental health issues. Those are the majority of our families that are coming to the attention of child welfare, and specifically that are being removed from their homes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Thank you, Director. I don't see any further questions. Really appreciate your service and your time. Moving on, Commissioner.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner. The next area of focus is our coordinated health and complex care unit. You know, when we became our own department 2.5 years ago, one of the areas of focus that we wanted to put a lot of attention onto was individuals that are sort of falling through the cracks, individuals with complex co-occurring health needs and behavioral health needs. And so we developed this unit partially out of necessity, but it was the right thing to do. And we really thought that putting some focus and energy into this was important for us. This unit really monitors cases across our own divisions within the division within the Department of Family and Community Services, and really trying to support those families and the caregivers within our divisions to help find placement for individuals. We also look at the whole system of care. So we're working with our sister agency over at Department of Health. It's really important to collaborate together and find ways to and find gaps in the system of care. I think you all will be hearing SB 76, which is being introduced. That's complex care residential homes. Collectively, through this body of work, we've identified that this is an area where we're not able to find appropriate least restrictive home-like settings for individuals. So we're hopeful that this will be something that helps us find homes for individuals that can meet their care needs. Also part of this unit, we have our designated evaluation and designated evaluation and stabilization and designated evaluation and treatment coordinator. We created this position back when this was Department of Health about 5 or 6 years ago. This individual tracks all of the Title 47s across the state, so all of the involuntary commitments that come to the attention of any of the facilities across the state. She's in constant contact with our hospital partners on a daily basis, sits in on the court hearings, and really has improve the movement of individuals getting to the care that they need at the time that they need it. So this has been a great success. The other piece that we added into this unit was to have our whenever we became our own department, we moved over the disagreements. So prior to the reorganization, the disproportionate share hospital agreements that provides underinsured individuals some funding sources for behavioral health in a hospital setting was being managed by the Division of Behavioral Health. That came over to the Department of Family and Community Services, and so we have an individual that monitors that. I do want to go back and just remind, as the commissioner was talking about Alaska Psychiatric Institute earlier, and we talk about we have the 60 adult beds, we also have three hospital partners across the state that provide designated evaluation and treatment services. And so that's Fairbanks Memorial with 20 beds, Mat-Su Regional with 16 beds, and then here in Juneau, Bartlett Regional with 12 beds. So that helps add to the continuum of care for those individuals that need to be committed for services.
Can I interrupt you there for a second? Is there some reason there – what's the facility in Anchorage that provides the similar services?
Chairman, there is an emergency psychiatric emergency room at Providence, but there is not a facility other than API in Anchorage that provides involuntary commitment services.
Okay. Thank you.
We've shown versions of this slide for the last couple of years in our presentation, and it just really goes to the point of how we as a department focus on the individual. Everything that we do is person-centered and working with that individual, their family, their caregivers, and making sure that they're getting the care that they need. This slide also demonstrates that within our own four divisions alone, how many touch points there are with any individual, and they oftentimes touch multiple entities, agencies, and resources within the community, whether it be public safety, Department of Corrections. There's workforce challenges in there. We've got our Medicaid and medical services. So as we're working through these individuals with complex needs, we're coordinating across many systems of care, many individuals, many agencies to make sure that we're getting them the care that they need. And so it's just a way of demonstrating the complexity of these complex individuals.
For the record, Kim Koval. So this is our value-guiding principles that we have here. Our vision is service first, and we really hold that to heart. Furthermore, we look at strengthening lives through meaningful connections with families, communities, tribes, and partners, and providing safe, person-centered care with integrity and dignity to the Alaskans we serve, advancing an agency culture that prioritizes the well-being of our workforce, and then mobilizing innovative solutions to complex challenges. And what we're going to do is we're going to share a bit of accomplishments, and each director listed out some very specifics, and then we actually have more to share as we're going through the balance of the presentation. So the first one is strengthening lives. And this is where we talk about building relationships with our community partners, tribal partners, nonprofits, advocacies, organizations, et cetera. And for example, DJJ has a partnership with Cook Inlet Tribal Council, or CITC, and the Alaska Native Justice Center, ANJC. And these agencies help support our Alaska Native cultural programming that we deliver for the youth in our facilities. And then we also look at the treatment planning for the youth that are needing secure treatment services as well with these agencies. Another example is the Rural Alaska Community Action Program partnership. And they're providing and promoting positive development through the Resource Basket Tool, the Resource Basket Toolkit. And the toolkit provides juvenile reentry, peer education, restorative practices, and grant management information for Alaska Native tribes. Another example is API collaborates with ANMC, and we do a lot of culturally appropriate meals. Our DJJ residents do hunt and fish with our staff, and we donate gifts of game meat and fish for our other residents throughout our other facilities. And we host a plethora of family nights, and we invite the community to come in. I will tell you that ice creams on Friday is the most popular, and we have families that they may not have youth or elders with us, and they still come and celebrate and hang out with us and enjoy Sundays. So the Sunday ice cream days are a lot of fun on Fridays. The next one that we have is person-centered care. And this is where we're looking at developing adaptable service models that can be customized to meet diverse needs of different families and communities. This is where we really strengthen our relationships between our four divisions, and then also how we are collaborating with our sister agencies, health, public safety, administration, labor, DEED, et cetera, and DOC. And then we're also looking at how we're doing TBI screening for youth at DJJ. We screen RLR youth for TBI, and then we also are looking at evidence-based practices like parents as teachers and early childhood mental health systems of care as well.
Okay, again, for the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner. So we're going to we've already talked a little bit about some of the workplace well-being and things that we're doing within our divisions as you were talking to some of the directors. But I'll just highlight a few additional items for you. Just putting in context, the Department of Family and Community Services, even though we split from the Department of Health and Social Services into two new agencies, we are the one of the largest agencies by PCN count, so by personnel count, with nearly 1,900 positions across the state with a budget of $485 million. Whenever we became our own department, one of the areas we always talk about, we always do a great job of caring for individuals in the community and the people that come into our care. But oftentimes, one of the deficiencies that we recognized before we became our own department was that we needed to focus more on the individuals that do the caring, the ones that are working in our facilities. And so that is an area that we really put into focus, and the commissioner has brought a lot to that as she came on board with us when we became a new department. The commissioner holds quarterly town halls across the system, and so she typically does three in one in a given day, so we make sure we hit every shift, remembering that all of our facilities and services are 24 hours a day, so we want to make sure that we capture all of those. The commissioner's always doing pop-ins, and sometimes it scares people whenever the commissioner pops in, but it's something that they have said that they had never seen before. They had never seen a commissioner that was there all of the time. She's always, and when she comes, she always brings cookies or brings something sweet, so they love having her there. And then some of our divisions are doing things like fireside chats so that they listen to the employees, so the employees have a voice, and town halls, API does a town hall, which they're having one here in a couple of days. So it's really trying to engage with staff, giving them a voice and making sure that their voice is heard. And we take that information to make improvements. We're doing employee engagement, trying to figure out ways to really improve the well-being of our staff, just giving them kudos. And we've some of the divisions have raised money and through parties or had a food truck come and celebrate the staff. Putting some initiatives into employee training, making sure that we have things like wellness officers in the Office of Children Services. So those are just a few of the many workforce and well-being initiatives that we've been implementing. Also looking at innovative solutions, we talked about a few of these, and I was going to highlight on some of the great work that's happened in being able to bring down some of the turnover rates. Staffing, coming out of the pandemic, staffing has been a challenge, and it's especially a challenge in areas where we're competing with the same staff in the same community. So, for instance, whenever we look at Fairbanks, and I think Director Hamilton spoke to it a little bit, the Fairbanks Pioneer Home is still struggling with staffing, and we're looking at some innovative solutions on ways to get some support staff in there to help those so that we can set that baseline and be able to relieve the pressure off of the current staff, thinking and hoping that that will help us to recruit new staff, because new staff don't want to come into a place that's already understaffed in the beginning, right? Same with the youth center in Fairbanks, we were having a large staffing problem. We were able to do a rate increase for the staff about a year and a half ago, and I'm happy to say that we're pretty much fully staffed for what we can accommodate right now at that facility. We are getting ready to go through a renovation project that is out for bid right now, and so that is holding us back from filling the entire facility. But right now, we're making some great ground on staffing at that facility. One of the other innovative solutions that we have done is juvenile justice, and I think, Senator Giesel, you were talking about individuals in juvenile justice with behavioral health, mental health. Juvenile justice has implemented neurofeedback therapy, so really looking at the neurological and behavioral needs of the youth within their services. They are doing that out in Bethel and also at the Fairbanks Youth Facility. So we look to expand that, but that is a really important aspect of understanding the behaviors of individuals and what is causing them to come into our services. The next slide that we're looking at is, again, talking about some of those department initiatives. We mentioned that we had the Fairbanks Youth Facility renovation project. There's a reappropriation in this year's capital budget to move, as I think Director Davidson was discussing, we're moving $4 million, proposing to move $4 million down to McLaughlin so that we can invest into that what we call the court unit. We're utilizing it for court because it was not feasible to use for youth. I just want to sort of talk about that just a little bit and explain why we decided to make that change. So whenever we first requested the money for the capital project for the Fairbanks Youth Facility, we had big plans of looking at, you know, could we do a much larger renovation project, potentially tearing down part of the facility and building something new. As you know, coming out of the pandemic, all of the cost went through the roof. So in order to do that, it was just not financially sustainable to do that. So what we did was retained a large portion of the money in Fairbanks, and we're putting it into that. We're doing a remodel on the treatment unit, remodeling the probation and the entry area of the facility. But we decided to be good stewards of state funds, let's propose moving some of the money down and be able to open up that unit in the McLaughlin Youth Center too and use those funds that were already appropriate. So that is a proposal in this year's budget, and that's the rationale. We continue to look at emphasizing on workforce well-being. It's really important to make sure that that the staff feel safe and supported. And then the last initiative that I'll talk about is looking at talent acquisition. So Assistant Commissioner Sweet created a talent acquisition team, and part of that was really trying to drive down the numbers and the number of days that it takes from the time you have a vacancy to the time you get a new individual into that position. It's a cumbersome process in state government, just from the, you know, you get the resignation, you create the posting, you do the interviews, you get somebody in. And on average, that was taking about 45 days. Assistant Commissioner Sweet and her team have been able to drive that number down from 45 days to 10 days. Mm-hmm. Now, with any new initiative, and it's a small but mighty team, we've had a little bumps in the road, and so we're sort of reevaluating and resetting up that team. But it has a lot of promise, and we hope there will be a gold standard for the state of Alaska.
Go ahead, Commissioner. Actually, sorry, I thought that she was going to add to that. Let me pause. You've just a second, Deputy Commissioner. I wanted to ask you about the technological improvements that's on here. So your sister agency obviously had some pretty severe challenges in the last 2 years with electronic processing of certain kinds of applications and a large backlog. And in those hearings, we realized that we had some really antiquated systems, that we had public-facing systems that were paper-based, We had online systems. Even if they were online, the back end was manual. That is, the form would spit out something in like an Excel spreadsheet or even worse, MS-DOS in some cases, I think. And then they would have to be manually entered into a different system. And so I'm wondering, is there – obviously, you have fewer public-facing forms, but are all your sort of public-facing things online? And for your intake, is it automated, or is there still a lot of things that have to be sort of, you know, hand-jammed?
Yeah, thank you for that, Senator. So we've been making a lot of improvements in various initiatives and innovations. So for instance, at the Pioneer Homes, so the application process to get on the wait list or come into the Pioneer Homes was always a manual process. We've now made that digital. So now you can fill out the application online and that automatically sends it through. We're also doing some initiatives in some of our divisions of really taking some of the old antiquated paper and scanning it so that we have it in a digital format so that we're not having piles and piles of paper in the background. We've also implemented a new electronic health record system for the Alaska Pioneer Homes. We're working on a new electronic health record system for Alaska Psychiatric Institute. So that's in the development phases right now. So we've already purchased that that software. One of the areas that we're still challenged with, and I think we'll continue to make improvements in many of these other areas, but one of the areas is with our what's called the CWIS system, our child welfare data system. It is antiquated, and we're looking at ways that we can improve that. I think that those questions have come up in the past on how are we going to do that. It's not an inexpensive endeavor. So looking at that, the costs are about $80 million to replace that system. And so how do we do that? We're looking at phased approach, and if there's a way we can do that in a phased approach so that it would be, you know, potentially feasible to be able to replace a system. But I think one of the other challenges that we look at as we're looking at the phased approach is we have to still maintain the current system while you're phasing in. So how do you do that in a way that you're not putting more pressure and burden on the already stressed system? So those are just a few of the items, Senator.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. And yeah, the price tags get astronomical, but this is just what these things cost. We went through the SAP debacle in Anchorage. It ended up costing, I think the original quote was $9 million, ended up costing $87 million. And so you can see how these things can spiral out of control. But at the same time, we have to do it. You have to update your software. And so good luck to you, I guess, is my only message there. Thank you.
For the record, Kim Koval. Now we're going to go into future opportunities. We've shared a lot of really great, amazing items we move forward on, and these are the areas that we are still targeting and want to move forward as well. So the first one we have is we want to increase our foster home recruitment. Since the pandemic, we have seen a significant decrease in the number of foster homes. Prior to 2020, we had 1,456 licensed non-child specific foster homes. In 2022, as we exited the pandemic, we're at 1,143. And then currently we're at 920. Now, I want to be really clear, though, that our total licensed providers is 1,154. But for the sake of this, we're talking about the homes themselves. So we have put in place the placement and support unit at OCS. And this is another small and mighty group. And they're doing amazing work with connecting with potential families, caring for the current families. And then we're also starting a respite program for our foster parents because respite is a really big request. We do continue to see some challenges with daycare needs from families looking for if they're taking more children on, is there daycare services and spaces for them? We do see challenges with multi-generational families because other family members who may not be the actual foster parents may not be able to meet the barrier crime matrix that we have to ensure that they do. And then we do see more families engaging in private placements. Essentially, they do not want state involvement, and we respect that, and we still offer support and services just to kind of help them along the way. The current year, we did see the increase in the foster care base rate that was implemented by the legislature was an average of 30%. We do not have our data ready yet to share in regards to how much of that was a reason for having more foster parents retained or new parents coming on. but we are happy to share that since July 1st of 2024, and this is when the increase went into effect, we've had 348 applicants. So they're all in process. This does not mean all 348 will get cleared through, but we'll have better numbers as we get towards the end of the fiscal year. And this is a constantly evolving number, so we're really excited about those prospects. The next one we're looking at is, since we are a new department technically, but there are regulations on the books that needed to be dusted off. So we have been looking at the regulations, and we're currently looking through and seeing what needs to be updated, because we do have some that are decades and decades old and need a little refresher. We are also looking at expanding treatment foster care. This is a very important priority to us. Behavioral health roadmap project and the comp plan both included information and identification from multiple communities across the state that treatment foster homes are needed. Just to put in perspective, we do not have a license for treatment foster homes. We have a license for just the foster homes, and we're the only state without a treatment foster home license. So we do want to see how we can streamline this and align this better with Medicaid language as well. We are looking at our youth services transformation project. We're looking to make sure that youth are receiving appropriate services in the least restrictive settings. And we are very grateful, to the Department of Health and to the governor for putting forward the complex care residential home license legislation. We think this is going to be a really big step in that process. Two more. We have our expansion programming at API, and obviously, as we're creating these outpatient programs, we are hoping that this will bring down the wait list and that we see more folks who can be restored, and then the legal process can continue and victims can hopefully have their day in court and have justice there. And then increasing data management capacity. So we're looking at how we're able to centralize that data into a data lake so that we're all sharing it and we're not whipping out Excel spreadsheets and DOS and other scanned items. Any questions?
Senator Klayman.
The fact that we don't have any treatment foster homes and we're apparently the only state in the country, how did we manage to miss the boat on that? I assume that all 49 states didn't do it in 1 year, that was a process. What happened?
Thank you for the question. Through the chair, Senator Klayman, we do have certified treatment foster homes. So this would be other agencies that a family could go through to get certification, and then they can call themselves a treatment foster home. But there are a plethora of agencies doing all different types of certification, and we don't have one streamlined licensure for it, and we're the last state. So what we would like to see is something a little more streamlined so we can make sure that we have the language that coincides with federal guidelines and best practices, and families can continue to do the different certifications that they want to do. We feel this is a really enhanced way to approach the needs of the kids that need the treatment foster care.
What's a reasonable timeline? What's a reasonable timeline to where we actually can say we have now joined the other 49 states and have treatment foster homes?
Through the chair, Senator Klayman, well, ideally we'd love to see that coming forward sooner than later. It's not a difficult process. It's just like any other legislation to establish the statutory authority for us to do the license.
Is that legislative action? It's not something you can just do as a regulatory matter?
This would be legislative.
So do you anticipate – sorry to cut you off, Senator Klayman, but I think we have the same question. The Department of Health is bringing forward SB 76 to create a new license type for residential complex care homes. Do you anticipate that your department will bring forward something similar soon for the treatment foster homes?
Thank you for the question, Chair Dunbar. We anticipate that those conversations are going to hopefully wrap up here very quickly, and then we can approach some legislators in regards to who would be interested in having conversations with us in regards to the treatment license.
I'll just say that's great. I'll say for my part, the governor has asked for a bill through the Rules Committee. We're going to hear it here like any legislators, and we'll move it forward. So if you decide the administration wants to bring that forward, we'll treat it like any other legislation.
Thank you.
Do you have any additional questions? Senator Kiesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a few. Expanding programming at API and reducing the wait list and meeting needs and so forth. You know, API is a pretty high-level treatment, but Are you thinking about a partial hospitalization type program, which would be intensive therapy during the day, but the person goes home to a safe home in the evening? I mean, that's partial hospitalization. Is that under consideration?
Yeah, again, thank you, Senator Giesel. For the record, Clinton Lastly, Deputy Commissioner. Yeah, we're looking at all of our options. Really, what we're trying to do is identify how do we utilize the state's resources in the best way. We know that we have needs in various ways as we're looking at these new care settings that will become available, and as we look at crisis residential and crisis stabilization services, which hopefully will take some of the pressure off of our systems. We're starting to look down the road of if all of these things meet the needs as we think they're going to do and take some of the pressure off, how can we best utilize all of our facilities across the state to meet some of the needs that you're talking about, Senator?
Gotcha. Follow-up. So I have a question about now related to OCS. Expanding treatment, foster care would be one aspect, but increasing foster home recruitment. So about 3 years ago, the Alaska Impact Alliance was formed. Maybe it was 4 years. And that the goal of that group, it included OCS staff, was to really, particularly in rural Alaska, engage the community in helping families stay healthy and perhaps addressing issues that families were having. Has that been implemented in any way? Are you seeing benefit from that kind of approach?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Giesel. We are engaged with AIA, and Director Gui is on the line and has more operational line on that, so I will defer for her to answer that question.
Okay.
Director Gui, did you hear the question?
I sure did. Through the chair, Vice Chair Giesel, Alaska Impact Alliance has been working within communities. The communities that they've been working in is Metlakatla, Juneau, and Kenai. And they have an instrument that they're using that's research-based to help identify where the strengths and weaknesses are of the community and then what to do about that. I can get more information from Dr. Carmody on that. I do know that Kenai has really taken this to heart and is working very diligently within their community. I'm not as confident in what Juneau and Metlakatla have been doing after the community assessment. So I do know that they're working on different avenues there.
Great. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. If I may, thank you, Senator. I also want to mention, you know, I think that, one of the things that we realize is that, you know, the state cannot do everything, right? And so having these partners, and, you know, we were instrumental in helping, you know, sort of launch the Alliance, and they're doing great work. And I just wanted to give a shout out to them and just mention that they just launched their 907 navigation app. So it is an app that you can go on, any community member can go on, a family can go on, and it assists individuals with identifying resources. You can look statewide, you can look within your community, you can find anything from legal services to family support services to medical, behavioral health needs. So it's really an exciting initiative that they have done. So the Alliance is doing a lot of great work. As you know, in state government, everything sort of moves a little bit slow. We don't get things done as fast as we would like to, but they're putting a lot of efforts in. I really do think that, but to your point, Senator Giesel, that just even these little implementations, we call them little, but it's a major implementation for them, a 907 navigation app, because that is what families need. They need to know. Oftentimes, they don't know where to go for help, right, or for resources or services, even in their community. As we've traveled around to various communities, it's really interesting when we were doing the behavioral health roadmap with Department of Health, and we would go into even communities and villages, go into Bethel, and you bring all of the community members together. Even the people around the table did not realize the resources that were available in their own community. So this navigation app is going to, I think, could be a game changer for family members and individuals when they're looking for care.
Thank you.
May I? Senator Giesel, for the record, Kim Koval. And to just expand on that, we also have been working with partners that are providing more telehealth services, especially for our parents. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we hear often from our families is we set up these case plans and our expectations and working with the families and what they agree to. But then suddenly we are struggling to find that behavior service or that substance abuse treatment. And so working with our telehealth partners has really been a game changer. And we're seeing parents getting engaged and quicker, more so before the courts even have to say anything. So, I mean, it's really making a difference how our partners are stepping up. And we're trying to be good partners, making sure that we're supportive of them.
Very good.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Do you follow up?
Well, one other follow-up. You mentioned that there were private entities that were also helping relieve some of the foster care burden, right, the department. So you must be referring to like Beacon Hill, Safe Families for Children, those kinds of organizations?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, we have families who choose not to be engaged with OCS but do step up as kinship families. And so when we say private, that is what we mean, that they are not engaging in necessarily all the state resources and they're not going through certain licensure. We do encourage them. We will essentially hold their hand through the whole process to encourage them to do it. But we do have families who choose not to because they don't want to partake of the state services.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. I think that's your last slide, if you want to go to last one. Appreciate your presentation. Do you have any closing remarks, Commissioner?
Through the chair, thank you. We just really appreciate the time, and we do appreciate the questions. And I believe we have one follow-up question for you for API that will look at the days of treatment for forensics.
Excellent. Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, so appreciate everyone here and the presentation today. The next meeting of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee will be Thursday, February 6th. We will have a presentation, an introduction on the aforementioned Senate Bill 76, and we will bring up the CS for Senate Bill 44. So with that, the time is 4:33, and this meeting is adjourned.